KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Alaska is a fascinating and occasionally terrifying place to be a journalist. There are incredibly complicated issues to dissect, examine, and then explain. There are captivating characters to interview, and there's never a shortage of stories to tell. Three longtime Alaska journalists are saying goodbye to the profession. What have they learned along the way, and how has their work evolved over the decades? That's just ahead on Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
Are you responsible for a growing team of healthcare workers? Now's the time to invest in your team. When you enroll by June 30th, the Alaska Primary Care Association will cover the full cost of training and apprenticeship programs to help your employees get certified, advance their skills, and stay within your organization. Visit AlaskaHealthcareCareers.com to learn more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Primary Care Association.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
This is Talk of Alaska. I'm Annie Feit, in for Lori Townsend. The road to journalism is sometimes an interesting and winding one. It's often a profession that finds you instead of the other way around. And once you're in it, it can be very hard to leave. Despite many flaws, low pay, long hours, and tight deadlines, to name a few, journalism is also a really incredible career. And that is doubly true in Alaska. So today on Talk of Alaska, we have three guests who have decided it's time to make an exit. And before they have a chance to get too far away, I wanted to turn the microphone around and ask them to talk about their careers. Joining me today are Rob Woolsey, news director at KCAW in Sitka, Ann Raup, who recently retired as the photo editor for the Anchorage Daily News, and Robin, a reporter for KUAC in Fairbanks. Thanks so much for being here.
Welcome. Yeah, glad to be here.
Yeah, and first I want to hear your stories of how you got into journalism in Alaska. So, Rob, let's start with you. How did it happen?
Okay. Sure. And thanks for having me on, Annie. And can I say what a cruel irony it is that you ask a reporter to be on to give an interview.
Right.
With just 2 weeks left on the job.
I'll second that.
You know, at last in the hot seat. It is really a weird feeling. I'm sure Anne and Robin feel the same way.
Absolutely.
Anyway, I think my story is very similar to a lot of people who come to Alaska. I came up here right after college, and I worked as a gillnet deckhand in Wrangell. Shout out to all the folks in Wrangell, John MD and the Quadra. I don't think John is around anymore, but the Quadra might still be gillnetting. And I worked as kind of a carpenter's gopher in Wrangell. And I think humpies at the time were selling for about 10 cents a pound. And at the end of the summer, I believe I had amassed a fortune of about $300. And I decided to buy a ferry ticket and head south. And I ended up getting an apprenticeship at a publishing company, not an apprenticeship, an internship, and sort of developed my editorial chops working in the conventional press. But I had fallen in love and moved back to Alaska and ended up as a park ranger in Sitka. And while in Sitka, I volunteered at KCAW, and I got to know Lisa Bush, who was our reporter here at the time. And Lisa has since gone on to fame as the director of the Sitka Sound Science Center, and she's recently retired as well. But at the time, she was just going freelance, and I was volunteering. I was learning how to produce and do things at the station, and I became her sort of producer and editor for some work she was doing on two big series called Alaska Natives in Science and Alaska Women in Science. And I traveled all over the state with Lisa working on all kinds of fascinating stories. And I was, you know, I was carrying all the equipment. And when we would get back to Sitka and work on the scripts, I'd do the edits and things. And that's when it sort of dawned on me that this is a pretty fascinating career, but I had never been on live radio. So for a 40th birthday resolution, I decided I'm going to be on radio. And I applied to be morning host at KCAW. And my first day on the job was September 10th, 2001.
Wow.
And I thought, well, anybody could do this, you know? I should have been doing this a long time ago. And of course, the next day for every morning host everywhere was an unbelievable day. We were on the air beginning September 11th. I think we were on the air 24/7 for about 2 weeks, just in rotation. And at some point during those 2 weeks, I realized that this really is my calling, that I just, this kind of service really resonates with me, helping people stay informed, helping them stay calm, helping them, you know, just remain current on this really complicated world. And so that's what I've been doing ever since.
Which is kind of incredible, because many people, I think, would have gotten the opposite, you know, out of that September 11th experience and decided, no way is this for me. But...
Well, I think we all find our calling different ways. Mm-hmm. You know, and that was definitely, that rang the bell for me, for sure. And after a couple of years as morning host, I got promoted to news director, unbelievably. I felt very unqualified at the time, but I've had a lot of on-the-job experience. And I'm going to be passing it on to Catherine Rose here in at the end of the month.
Anne, how about you?
Well, it all started... I was in undergraduate school in Minnesota, of all places, in a little town in south central Minnesota, and I was well on my way to going to law school. That was my whole deal. I was going to study environmental science and then go get a law degree, but I got wrangled into a yearbook staff and was taught the darkroom skills, and that's kind of where the magic started to catch hold for me. But also, having always photographed landscapes, you know, mountains, animals, flowers, whatnot, I was now photographing people, and I was like, oh, this is good. I like this. It's just a whole new dimension. And ended up taking a long trip after undergraduate school, traveled, shot a lot of film, emphasis on film.
Right.
And then came back and thought, you know, I think I really want to be a photographer instead of going to law school. I made a cold call at the Denver Post, walked in the door, said, can I talk to a photographer? Just kind of need to know more about this photojournalism thing, which I really was pretty clueless about at the time. And he just said, go to the University of Missouri. So I did. And once I was there, it really caught fire, and it stuck with me, and it really lit a fire that has never died. I just love telling the stories of people, the places they live in, things they do, things that challenge them, and passing those on to readers. So that's where I've been.
And then how did you end up in Alaska?
Well, I had a bunch of internships. One was in Ogden, Utah. One was in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And one was St. Louis. But then I got my first job back in Ogden, Utah. So I worked at the Standard Examiner in Ogden for 5 years before getting the chance to apply for the job here in Anchorage, which was kind of like this. It never happened. There were never openings here. But I applied, got the job, was a staff photographer for 5 or 6 years, and I've really never stopped shooting. But about 2001, I became the assistant photo editor. So then I was kind of doing both. I was shooting some, I was editing a lot. And then in 2011, I became the photo editor full-time. and have been in that seat ever since.
Cool. Yeah. I want to invite listeners into this conversation. Do you remember a particular story or photo of my guest today, or have questions about what it's like to work in radio or at a newspaper? Give us a call at 1-800-478-8255. If you're calling from Anchorage, please dial 550-8422. You can also email us at talk@alaskapublic.org. And Robin, I want to get your story. How did you find this profession in Alaska?
Well, I'm going to back just jump in and say I forgot that I also had a similar 9/11 story to Rob. Wow. I had been working for a little local public commercial television station here in Fairbanks, and I was trying to quit and go back to teaching journalism because I had been given like an adjunct position at the university. And I couldn't do both. So I was scaling down my hours, and it was my last day was supposed to be the 13th of September. So, yeah. And so I didn't quit. I stayed on.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, you all hands on deck. And, and so way back, my origin story, I guess, is I was in high school when during the Nixon administration and the two upstart, pretty boring, ordinary reporters at the Washington Post were writing these articles about the president being corrupted, and it just blew the country away. People were dumbfounded. At first, they didn't believe it, and then as more evidence came in, they were like, is this possible? Could our president think that he's above the law? Is that even a thing? Not in the U.S.? And it was just dumbfounding. But the power of the pen struck me so hard about how might the mighty have fallen through just hard work, diligence, not giving up. So I went and joined my student newspaper at the high school, and then decided to take it up in college. And my mother was very discouraging. She was like, "You really need to take computer science," This is Silicon Valley in the 70s. So everybody was making amazing inventions and leaps and bounds technologically. And I was reporting on them rather than doing it. So I did take a couple of computer science classes to please my mother. But
that didn't stick.
No, and yeah. And then went on to the university. And then my sister had moved to Alaska as a land scientist, and Alaska was crazy hiring professionals in the early 80s because all the pipeline money was coming in, and the infrastructure, the professional infrastructure of the institutions wasn't there to hold up all the need. So she got plucked out of her university and loved Alaska, was here for a couple of years, and she said, "You got to come up here. The streets are paved with gold and lined with men." And neither of which is true, but okay, the lined with men part was probably true. And I walked into the Fairbanks Daily News Miner office with a resume, believing that everybody was trying to hire women to fill out their affirmative action quotas, even if they didn't actually have one. They were thinking, wow, women can work the same as men. And Stan Jones, who was the Newsminer editor at the time, opened up his desk file drawer and he said, "See this? These are all resumes. I'll put yours in here, but I'll put it in the back."
Oh, wow.
So it was pretty discouraging. So I drove cab for a while in Fairbanks and volunteered at the public radio station and ended up getting hired very part-time on the TV side of KUAC FM and TV. And KUAC TV had a weekly talk show with the journalism professors at the university on news of the day, news of the week. And I was in the right place at the right time when they needed to make a hire. And that's my story.
That's great. And you all have spent most of your careers in Alaska, if not all of your journalism careers here. But do you have a sense of how the profession is different up here than in the lower 48?
Oh, I could answer that pretty quickly. As a photographer, in the lower 48, you would often find yourself in a scrum of other photographers trying to get the shot, whatever, at any event. It was, if it was sporting, if it was political, whatever it was. And in Alaska, it was like this breath of fresh air. You had space to move as a journalist. And that was a huge relief for me anyway, and gave me a lot more freedom to look for different angles, look for different shots.
Okay. Interesting. And Robin, did you want to jump in there?
Well, and it's the public radio network that is different. It is unique to the States. We have something that no other place in the United States has. And I didn't know anything about it when I first came up here, and I was a little bit stunned to listen to, when I was bunking with my sister and listening to the radio she had constantly on to public radio. And at, I think it was 5 p.m. at the time in Fairbanks, there'd be the show called Alaska News Nightly, and reporters were calling in from all over the state with, over the phone. They would call in stories over the phone, and then it would go on out back to the stations over a phone line. So you'd hear this, welcome to Alaska News Nightly. And there wasn't anything like that. I mean, there was certainly public radio where I had come from in California, but it wasn't a cohesive network of people trying to unify the state. And even getting like the Anchorage Daily News, the Fairbanks Daily News Miner, the Juneau Empire, didn't have the same journalistic gravitas that the public radio network does.
Right. Yeah, that is a big difference. I know the tools for doing the job have changed a lot for all of you. Can you talk about that? Rob, let's start with you on that one.
Oh, AI is coming on big these days. And I've had people say, well, I guess AI could pretty much do your job now, Rob. And I haven't really been all that nervous about it, because you and I both know, Annie, that we've been using AI for years now. As soon as it became a practical tool for reporters, we dove in, and we've been using AI to transcribe the hours and hours of audio that we accumulate at planning commission meetings, at assembly meetings, long interviews with politicians. We have an AI assistant that transcribes all of this, so we can go back and review it, and that is fantastic. But just the digital world has improved our ability to do what we do, which is, process a lot of information and process it in a way that listeners or our audience or our readers can have a takeaway and some better understanding of whatever the situation is that we're talking about. And that's the human skill, is deciding how to best sort of write a story and convey it in a way that people might be standing in line at the grocery store and talking about it with each other. So these tools, the digital editing and websites have all sort of enabled us to do our jobs so much better. But I do remember one time I was so locked in to recording cassette tapes and logging them that our general manager at the time, Ken Fate, came in with a mini disc player. And he's like, look at this, Rob, you can just plug it right into your computer and you don't have to dub any audio. You don't have to dub it. You can just go in and find it and copy it and paste it, just like a word processor. And I'm like, get that thing out of my face, over my dead body. Am I going to do anything with that little thing? It looks like a kid's toy. And of course, I adopted the mini disc player, And then they had to pry it out of my hands so that I could use a digital recorder. And now, of course, we can walk in just about anywhere with our iPhones and record audio, take pictures, and send it all back and have our AI assistant process it. And we just come back to the studio and, right. and write the story. So, yeah, there's been some changes. And I've been dragged along with every single one of them.
The mini disc, I have not thought about that in a while. That was like a moment. Maybe a year or something that the mini discs were in use. How about you, Anne? A lot has changed in photography, of course.
Yeah. I mean, I started in the darkroom, as I said, rolling my own film and developing all the film, both color and black and white, and making black and white prints. And it was funny. In graduate school, all the professors are like, yeah, we're going to go to digital. It's going to be digital in 5 years, so that would have been in the mid-80s. So we had to roll through another decade and a half before digital cameras got really good enough for use for publication. So the Anchorage Daily News started to go to digital cameras right around 2000, 2001. And that just instantly changed everything because no longer did we have to spend time in the darkroom. We had to spend a whole lot more time on the computers because that's where all the editing happened instead of a light table. And then just getting the images to press or to AP or whatever became much easier, much faster. So that really changed all that flow. So it's better environmentally, it's faster. There's a little less magic, maybe, but... on the AI front, for photography, we have always had to have radar up high to look for fakes. Mm-hmm. Because even back in the days of Lincoln, Civil War, there was already malicious things happening with prints trying to fool people. So we've always been on the lookout for that. But now it's harder than ever, and I'm really not sure what AI is going to do for photojournalism. It's pretty fraught. It's pretty dangerous ground, as we've seen in so many instances of faking images or just faking whole situations. So it's quicksand, and we're going to just have to work our way through that into the future.
Yeah. We asked you to choose one memorable photograph from your career. Can you talk about one right now that you want to highlight? It's a little hard to talk about photos on the radio, but, you know, do your best.
I guess I have more memorable stories. I know I've got memorable images. Mm-hmm. I think some of my early work before I got to Anchorage really stand out in my mind because it was when I was really just starting to see light the way you have to see light for the magic moments. I have a picture of a fish market in Japan that I still just love because of the way the light shines on the fishmongers and the whole scene. I have, actually, this was kind of funny because this also segues into a favorite story. I got to go, I was shooting the Iditarod that year, and back in the day, we would always go out with a musher for a trip before the race actually happened. So I got to go out with Charlie Boulding, and he took us by sled out to his house. Charlie Boulding dumped me off his sled, and I got a picture of him, not of the actual dump, but just a picture of Charlie Boulding holding his sled while I'm sitting in the sled that I still really love that. The memory, the picture's pretty good too.
Yeah, that's great. What do you think the audience misunderstands about journalism? Robin, do you want to jump in on this one?
Yeah, I think they don't know that, that journalists are, like, today's audience doesn't know that journalists are professionals, that we are vetting the news carefully. We try to be balanced. We try to make sure voices are heard, that voices that aren't included normally, that when people are living in their silos. I held up my hand and I swore an oath. I don't think that that's done very much these days. As a society professional journalist, code of ethics, that I would abide by the code of ethics of fairness and accuracy. And I think someone who's getting their news from a friend on Facebook is not, doesn't understand, or even just a link to a legacy media institution, doesn't understand that those people have been trained, that those people, not necessarily with a bachelor's degree in journalism, maybe they're a scientist or a musician, but they've been trained, and that they are, and spend hours of their day carefully vetting the information to make sure that it's accurate, that it's representative, that it's important to the listener, viewer, reader, and then we publish it, and we have scads of notes and lots of information about the background. So journalists are an incredible resource for a community, that, and people don't seem to know that today.
Yeah, I agree. Rob, do you have thoughts here?
I do have thoughts. Yeah. I think of the job of public radio reporter. My job is, it's a lot like, you know, it's a lot like school teacher or librarian, or maybe, you know, something more, I don't know, like the engineer who designs the airport runway, or maybe the building you're in right now. These, you know, we provide kind of a service in the background that we want it done well. And there's often not a lot of flash to it, but we want credible, timely news. We want runways that don't, you know, collapse into the ocean. We want these things to be done well. And I think probably that's not understood well by the public right now, because there is just a lot of high, a lot of sort of money-driven media, whether it's the national media, where they're really in the market for ratings, and you know, sensationalism is not something that even, you know, the sort of the neutral media organizations are immune to. And certainly online, you know, when you're getting news, that person who's providing it might be more interested in clicks than informing you about something, the same way that, you know, I feel that when I go into a room, a meeting, a public meeting, or I pull out my microphone to interview, you know, Senator Murkowski or somebody, that I represent, you know, the listener. I represent the public. I'm not there. It has nothing to do with Rob Woolsey. It has everything to do with the person I'm talking to and the audience that I'm preparing the story for. And I'm in the middle. I'm the media, and it's not about me. And I think a lot of people think that journalism has become about the reporter and about his or her ideology and about some kind of message that they might be trying to convey in the kinds of stories they write and how they write them and how they choose the stories to write. And bloggers have not helped this image at all. And I think it's really important that we hang on to this tradition and that we pass it on to the people who are coming after us, particularly in public media, that we're not there for us. We're there for you.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. I want to move on to the lightning round here. So we're going to do a few quick hit questions here. What is the most fun story or photograph you can remember? Anne, you want to go first on this one?
Sure. I think my all-time favorite was a story that we did about a glaciologist doing seismic monitoring on the flanks of Iliamna volcano. So a reporter and I got flown up on a helicopter way up high, and had to step out of the moving helicopter with crampons, and and then just we hung out there while they were working on the station, and it was just so otherworldly and just an amazing experience all around.
That sounds incredible. Robin? Most fun story?
I think I'm going to say it was this year's Yukon Quest, which is an assignment I have avoided for decades. And I keep thinking, I'm going to actually get out without having to do this. And then this year, we had a plan. KUAC FM has covered the quest since 1984. So we've always had a trail reporter on there. And it's kind of because people don't understand there is another 1,000-mile race besides the Iditarod. So we figured it was our obligation to keep that in public awareness, even after it kind of changed dramatically during the pandemic and the Canadians sort of pulled out and did their own race. So this year it was a 550, and we had a plan, and at the last minute, the day of, the reporter couldn't do it and had a family emergency. So I stepped in and started to, I said, well, I'll cover the start. And then by the end of that afternoon, texting back and forth, we had a plan for me to go up on the trail. And I was thinking, can I do this? Can I make it happen? And my husband was so excited. He's like, I'll drive you. And he went, we had BlizzX on our vehicle, and he went and got studded snow tires because Fairbanks has, the climate's been changing lately and being more icy. Anyway, instead of a lot of work, it was a lot of fun. And I went all the way up to Circle, and the school kids, there's like 8 of them, and they asked me about journalism and reporting and covering the quest. And that was a really fun hour. And then handed off the back end of that race to another new colleague. And that was also really great to like give it up halfway and go, hey, I can check that box.
Yeah, that's a real Alaska reporting adventure. Rob, how about you?
What's the subject? Most fun?
Most fun story.
Okay, so quite a few years ago, before it was the Forest Service opened it to the public, I got to go in El Capitan Cave on Prince of Wales Island. It's 2 miles one way. It's the deepest cave in Alaska. And I remember before going in, the Tongass cavers were teaching me how to rappel off the side of a trailer house. And I'm like, why are we rappelling? I thought we're going into a cave. And they're like, just you wait.
And oh, wow.
So, yeah, so there was technical rope work inside the cave and a lake at the end of it. And I was very tired exhausted by the whole process. And I remember the people who took me in, Connie and Marcel LaPerriere, who I thought were just absolutely ancient. They must have been 40 years old, Annie. I'm sure they were 40. I mean, they had gray hairs. I dragged myself out of El Capitan Cave, and Connie LaPerriere said, oh yeah, yesterday Marcel and I took our scuba gear in and we climbed, we dove in that lake. And so that not only was it fun, it instilled me with a lifelong devotion to fitness. So thank you both.
Wow. That does sound terrifying, actually, to me. We need to take a quick break, but we'll hear more from 3 retiring journalists when Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Invasive plants and animals threaten Alaska's waters and can spread to new locations by hitching a ride. Anyone can help stop aquatic hitchhikers by remembering to clean boots, boats, and trailers to remove plants, animals, and mud, drain bilge, ballast, and buckets before leaving the area, and dry equipment before using it in a new body of water. Learn more at stopaquatichitchhikers.org. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. I'm Annie Feit, and today we're talking to three journalists who are saying goodbye to the profession after long careers in the state. We'd love to have you join the conversation. Call 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. If you're calling from Anchorage, please dial 550-8422 or email us at talk@alaskapublic.org. And we do have one caller on the line right now, Mark from Bethel. Hello, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hi, good morning. First, I just want to say thank you to all three of you for doing such a great job over the years, keeping Alaskans informed. And so my question is, what story or stories do you wish you had been able to cover, or maybe have covered in more depth? And along with that, what enterprise stories do you wish you could have done through your careers? So I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Who wants to take that one? That's a good question. Robin?
I'm pondering.
Everybody's thinking, pondering.
But the stories that I wish I could get to are the ones that are really hard. Where, you know, like the sticky ones where someone's been damaged, but there's no accountability, or someone makes accusations about somebody and you can't prove it. There's no, it sounds terrible, like here an injustice has been done, but there's no way I can get my hands around the evidence or the statements that would help this person. And that happens more often than you think. People call the newsroom or they write in and say, you know, we've been screwed by this this company, and or we made a contract and they're breaching it, and help us out, you know, publicize this injustice. And then there's just not enough to make sure that that it's right. And that's so frustrating, and that happens more often than you think.
Yeah, that's a good answer. Anne, did you have something that comes to mind here?
It's a tough one. I mean, there are a lot of stories that I know I wanted to cover as a photojournalist, as a staff photographer, but then as I stepped into being an editor, I got to assign those stories to other people, and those are myriad. That's been a really wonderful part of my job. I guess I don't know. I think right now in this moment, there are so many stories that need to be told that are going to be really hard to get and very time consuming and lots of labor and lots of reporting. And that is foremost in my mind right now, that those are the stories that we, our colleagues, need to be running hard at.
There's always too many stories. Rob, how about you?
Yeah, I definitely appreciate the question. And I think the caller understands that we work on a daily deadline. I mean, especially in small newsrooms, we have to have daily content. So we do tend to go after some of the things that we can turn quickest, like, you know, that school board meeting or the meeting of, you know, the planning commission or the visiting scientist or, the traffic accident or whatever. We do a lot of that. And to do enterprise reporting takes a certain amount of capacity, which we have always worked toward. I mean, KCAW is a relatively small shop, but we've had an internship, a fellowship, and now a residency program, so we can get after some of these high-value, long-term projects. And I think the slowest burn for me over the years has been the idea that in World War II, the government rolled in here and had a massive buildup in Sitka, and I'm sure other places in Alaska experienced similar events, and a number of tribal and clan properties were just commandeered for military purposes. And over the course of the war, and the sort of energy that was, and the panic and the fear that was present during, you know, preparations for war and the Japanese invasion that never came down this far, those properties and their ownership and title claims sort of fell by the wayside. And now you've had 80, 90 years of people trying to reassert tribal ownership over certain places in Sitka. And I've had conversations with Sitka Tribe of Alaska attorneys over the years. And it's such an arduous process reasserting these claims. And I do think it's one of the biggest stories sort of our time, especially when it comes to something like herring, subsistence herring in Sitka, where the Sitka Tribe of Alaska is sort of reasserting indigenous control over traditional, longstanding traditional resources. We're beginning to see sort of a change in the tide that might ultimately benefit some of these families that have been deprived of property for decades. But getting to that story is very, very challenging under sort of the daily circumstances and deadline that we work under. So,
right.
Yeah, that is a regret of mine.
Yeah, well, talk about a story you did get to that you wanted to highlight, and this involves going into the belly of an airplane. We have a clip to play first off here.
I'm out on the ramp at Sitka's Rocky Gutierrez Airport, waiting with ramper Tim Fulton for the arrival of Alaska Airlines Flight 53. It's a nice day in midsummer, overcast, not raining.
So 30 years standing out here waiting for airplanes to show up. Do you have butterflies in your stomach or?
Nope, not anymore.
53 circles low over Sitka Sound and touches down, trailing ribbons of mist from its wingtips. Standing out here as the Boeing 737-800 pulls up to the gate is a trip, but the only place I'm going today is inside the belly of this beast.
This is my first time. Pretty cool.
I climb up the belt loader and into the aft belly with Fulton and his partner today, Craig Langenfeld.
Let's try this first. All right.
This is where Fulton's device will see its first full turnaround trial, unloading and then loading this luggage bin. Before I explain how the invention works, you should take a look at where it works. The aft belly is a dimly lit tunnel, about 25 feet long in this particular aircraft and just a little over 3 feet high. The luggage is all piled toward the front. It's not at all what I pictured. The rampers divide this space into areas.
You always do such a nice job painting a picture, Rob, but talk about that story, because that was one example of a story that you followed for a long time in Sitka. And,
I think Robin and Anne will agree that one of the best things about being a journalist is getting to experience the life of somebody with them while they're doing whatever it is they do. And before I met Tim Fulton, I just assumed that the baggage handlers underneath in the belly of the plane were kind of stacking up our luggage like library books on a shelf or something. And it's not like that at all. Tim Fulton did call me one day and said, I've invented something. And we all get those calls where it's like, oh, well, somebody has a notion about something.
Right.
But Tim Fulton was legit. He had been president of our school board in Sitka, and he made it no secret that he had never been to college. He was not particularly academic, but he had worked for Alaska Airlines for 38 years. And he had, over the course of his career, he had been slowly refining and perfecting a way to move luggage inside an aircraft luggage bin without having to throw it, because that's what they're doing inside the plane. It's like being in a coal mine down there,
and they're
on their knees or they're hunched over, and we see the luggage, you know, go up the conveyor belt from the baggage cart on the tarmac, goes into the plane, and we don't see it again. But somebody takes it at that doorway and throws it down all the way to the front of the luggage bin. And they do like bags with rollers, by the way, because in that case they can just push it and off it goes. But Tim Fulton had developed this kind of retractable conveyor belt system that could go up, that could be loaded into the plane first, and then sort of gradually folded down one segment at a time, and it would carry the luggage up to the guy stacking it in the front of the plane. And he called it Tisabas, which stands for Tim Saves Backs. And it was, I thought it was absolutely brilliant. And it was extremely technical. It was very efficient. And it worked extraordinarily well in that first trial that I got to go along with him on. And I think he was taking a risk. The whole thing could have been a disaster. It could have been one of those stories, oh, this thing didn't work at all. This guy spent 38 years, you know, developing a lemon of a product. But actually, it worked really, really well. And strangely enough, he could never get Alaska Airlines to buy it. He could never get, I don't think he got any domestic airline to buy it, but he did develop an overseas market for it. And he was building them here in Sitka. He had, his company was valued at $3 million, and it was three of them working on these things. And his vision was to have manufacturing here in Sitka for high school kids that, you know, were not college bound. And it looked like it was going to work. I mean, I am, I'm no judge of these things, but I know work and I know tools, and a tool that makes a job more efficient and easier in my mind is going to take off. It's like a nail gun, you know? It's,
yeah.
And nail guns are ubiquitous now. You know, when I had my carpentry job in Wrangell 30 years ago, nail guns were not ubiquitous.
Right.
But I thought this was the nail gun of aircraft luggage loading. And I did follow him as his company grew, and I spoke with him probably just about a month ago as he was, I think he was on the brink of, he was either going to file for bankruptcy or he was going to move his company to Brazil, where his wife is from, because Trump's tariffs had chased away several of his big international clients. Unfortunately, even though the machine is built here in the U.S., he required a number of the sort of the digital components were from Japan, and it forced him to raise the cost of his machine. His customers bolted, and so he was in kind of a pickle as to what to do next. But the guy has tremendous energy and tremendous vision, and I just admire the effort that he put into the entire project, and I still wish him the best. And I think I'm going to stay in touch with him even after my last day of work, just to see how it's going.
Yeah.
And I think about him every time he's loading, and every time I go on a flight and see people loading airplanes, I think, oh man, this
if
job
only
is
they
terrible.
Had this.
If only they had it to Sabas.
That's a great story. I hope you can follow it. We need to take one last quick break, but we'll hear more from Rob, Ann, and Robin when Talk of Alaska continues.
You can't drive very fast on this.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, proud of its ties to Alaska communities since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
Are you responsible for a growing team of healthcare workers? Now's the time to invest in your team. When you enroll by June 30th, the Alaska Primary Care Association will cover the full cost of training and apprenticeship programs to help your employees get certified, advance their skills, and stay within your organization. Visit alaskahealthcarecareers.com to learn more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Primary Care Association.
For more than four decades, Alaska News Nightly has brought you award-winning statewide news. From Dutch Harbor to Prudhoe Bay, from Metlakatla to Koktovik, Alaska News Nightly covers every corner of Alaska, keeping you up to date about the issues you care about most. Join me, Casey Grove, for Alaska News Nightly, weeknights on your local public radio station.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. I am Annie Feit. Today we're talking to three journalists who are saying goodbye to the profession. I have Rob Woolsey, news director from KCAW in Sitka, Ann Raup, who recently retired as the photo editor for the Anchorage Daily News, and Robin, a reporter for KUAC in Fairbanks. And we have one caller I want to get to now. Bob, hello. Welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Good morning. The wonderful story about Charlie Boulding and throwing one of you out into the snow from his dog team brings back a warm memory of I was headed out of Caltag with ski-joring cross-country skiing with two dogs that were, one of them was a Martin Boozer dog, but he said this dog is always going to be a team dog, won't ever learn yee-haw, and the other one is a rescue dog from the pound in Anchorage. But Charlie was zooming along during the Iditarod on this parallel trail, and he looks over at me curiously, quizzically, and he said, "You need more dogs." I had two, and he had 16.
Nice.
But I wanted to say thank you for your service to each of you. Knowing something about the economics of print journalism or public radio, I hope you have some kind of retirement and not just thanks for your service as the only reward. But I would just like to say, one of the mantras is speak truth to power. And I just wonder, to what extent does that apply to journalism as opposed to the editorial side, which is segregated completely? But do you consider whether it's worth risking upsetting an interviewee to get a better story or not?
Yeah, good question. Robin, do you want
to? Yeah, that is a constant question. And holding people accountable for bad behavior is an important part of what we need to do. And especially if that person has an implied promise to the public, an implied promise to the community, like an elected official, you know, someone who's on the city council, the borough assembly, the school board. And those people need to be held accountable for what they say and for what they do outside of their public duties, like when they're on social media slamming someone. I'm sorry, and I'm rambling. I want to make sure I get the question right.
Yeah, just like how do you view your role in terms of speaking truth to power? And I guess how much do you worry about upsetting? I thought that was a good part of the question, upsetting people in your reporting.
Alaska's filled with small towns, and the reporters have to live with, like right now I'm in Fairbanks. It's a little easier in Fairbanks than when I worked in Homer, where people would stop me in the grocery store and complain about a story that I had done. And I'm always asking myself, and reminding myself to whom I'm responsible, that I'm not responsible to those public officials. And I don't care if they stop me in the store and say bad things about me. It's the listeners, it's the community, it's the readers that those people serve that are my bosses.
Yeah. Rob, did you have anything to add here?
Yeah. I think it's important to speak truth to power through the questions we ask that kind of help, you know, clarify what people's, especially elected officials, what their policies and what their decisions are. And it's also important that the power speak the truth. I was sitting in the same room I'm sitting in now quite a few years ago, and I looked over my shoulder. It was a beautiful, quiet, sunny afternoon in Sitka. And walking up the sidewalk, I see Senator Ted Stevens. And he is, President Pro Tem of the Senate. He's third in line in succession for the presidency. He's also under indictment back in Washington, D.C. And he comes walking up the stairs into the radio station. He always felt very comfortable here. Comes into the newsroom and, you know, sits down and says, "Ask me anything." And, you know, I really appreciated that, and I will tell you what I asked him. I asked him why he didn't just use the phone book when he wanted to hire a contractor. Why he chose an oil field service provider. So anyway, it was an interesting, candid conversation, and I felt very much that you could have a candid conversation with someone like that. Of course, he's a politician and skilled at shaping his message. I feel the same way about Senator Lisa Murkowski. She doesn't shy away from the press, the media whatsoever, but she's also very skilled at shaping her message. And so I do think it's important to speak truth to power, but I also think it is a two-way street, and a lot of politicians feel that's not the case anymore.
Yeah. And I mean, this is such a challenging time for journalism in a lot of ways. What advice do you have for younger folks that are just starting out in the profession or considering it as a profession? Anne, do you want to start on that one?
Yeah, that's pretty tricky. I don't know how journalism schools are handling all the things now. I think skills are really different from what they used to be. So what they're teaching in the schools is a different thing. But the bottom line remains truth, and not just to power, but truth in general, so that you earn the trust of your readers, your listeners, because that trust has really been falling apart. Yeah. And is, I think, a huge part of the division that we have in society now. And if there's one thing that the young journalists can do is to start bringing back that kind of trust between readers, journalists, just kind of everybody, could take us a long ways ahead. I don't know if I would want to be in journalism anymore, just because it's gotten more, it is hands down more dangerous than it was.
Yeah.
I mean, witness things that happened in LA over the recent rally. So I think it's ever more complicated, but if you're still drawn to serve people, which I think everybody in this group did their whole careers, the fundamentals are still the same. You know, tell truth, learn your skills, learn how to tell the stories, and I think it's going to have to be more audience focused than it ever has been before, but that's part of the trusting piece.
Yeah. Robin, do you have thoughts here? You have young journalists working in your newsroom, I know.
Yeah, and we, I've also taught recently, and it's get to know your stuff, know your beat, know the community. When you're doing public meetings, get to understand, interview as many people as you can so you get as many perspectives as you can, so that when the liar emerges, you can recognize it. And mm-hmm. when you can recognize when you're being led by somebody. The polarization of our society, and I know I got to wrap it up because we're running out of time, mm-hmm. but the you're polarization good. Is something we want to, I'm still hoping for the reconciliation. I still like the middle. I still like it when people with different viewpoints come together and talk about their, in a civil way, their perspectives, so to help find solutions. And that happens much more on the local level than the national level. I've never imagined when I started that a politician could shut a journalist down, that they could say, no, I'm not going to take that question, or I'm not going to allow you in my press conference anymore, or physically pushing them or hitting them. And that happens, you know, that happened in Montana. And so politicians used to understand that they were responsible to journalists, that they could never say, I won't answer a question. And now that's frequent.
Yeah.
So I still want, the trust goes two ways. The journalist has to be faithful.
We do need to wrap it up here, Robin. Thanks so much. That's a good point to end it on. Chris Hyde was our engineer. Madeline Rose was our producer. Ava White and Sam Lang were on the phones. And I am Annie Feit. Thanks for listening to Talk of Alaska today.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.
You are listening to 830 AM KSDP in Sandpoint, Alaska.
KSDP, 830 AM in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, K KOLD 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
It's time now for your weather, tide predictions, and sunrise and sunset, starting with your coastal water forecast, courtesy of the National Weather Service of Anchorage, Alaska. From Sitkanap to Castle Cape, small craft advisory today. Today, northwest winds 25 knots, seas 5 feet. Tonight, north winds 15 knots, seas 3 feet. And Wednesday, variable winds 10 knots, seas 2 feet. Castle Cape to Cape Tolstoy.